Good morning, everyone. It's great to be back at this year's AFR Business Summit. I was here last year, and so it's very good to be here again. As you would be aware, the Reserve Bank Board met yesterday, and we left the cash rate unchanged at 1.5%. And I'd like to take this opportunity to highlight some of the issues we discussed at yesterday's board meeting. Before I do that, though, I'd like to focus on the housing market and its implications for our economy. Readers of the Monetary Policy Board minutes would have noticed that at its February meeting, the board discussed a special paper on this topic, which took a deep dive into the housing market, and my remarks today draw on that paper. I'll first discuss the current state of the housing market. I'll then discuss the main drivers of the recent movements in housing prices before turning to the implications of housing prices for the broader economy and our financial system. As you would all know, Australians watch housing markets very carefully, perhaps more so than citizens of any other country in the world. Over the 5 years to late 2017, we saw nationwide housing prices increase by almost 50%. You can see that in this first chart here. Since their peak, prices have fallen by 9%, and that's brought them back to the levels they were in mid-2016. As you can see in this chart, declines of this magnitude are unusual, but they're not unprecedented. In 2008 and 2010, prices fell by a similar amount as they did on two occasions in the 1980s. In the 1980s, the rate of CPI inflation was higher than it is now, so inflation-adjusted terms, the declines in the 1980s were larger than the ones we're currently witnessing. These nationwide figures mask considerable variation across the country. The run-up in prices over recent years has been most pronounced in Sydney and Melbourne, so it's not surprising that these two markets have seen the largest declines recently. In Perth and Darwin, the housing markets have been weak for some time, affected by the swings in population growth and income associated with the mining investment boom. And in contrast, the housing market in Hobart, as you can see, has been quite strong recently. In Adelaide, Brisbane, Canberra, and most parts of regional Australia, conditions have been more stable. Given these contrasting experiences, it's pretty clear that there's no such thing as the Australian housing market. What we have is a series of separate but interconnected markets. Another window into the housing market is provided by rents. Over recent times, the nationwide measures of rent inflation have been running a bit less than 1%, and that's the lowest in three decades. As with housing prices, though, there's a lot of variation across the country. Rents have been falling for 4 years in Perth, and they're now down on average around 20% in Perth. In contrast, rents in Hobart have been rising at the fastest rate for some years. As is pretty well understood, shifts in sentiment play an important role in housing markets. When prices are rising, people are attracted to the market in the hope of capital gains. At some point, though, valuations become so stretched that demand tails off and there's a shift in momentum. But when prices are falling, the same thing happens. The prospect of capital losses leads buyers to stay away or delay their decision to purchase. At some point, though, the lower prices draw more people into the market. First homeowners find it easier to buy a home. Investors attracted back into the market by the higher yields. And trade-up buyers take the opportunity to upgrade to the home they've always wanted. So these shifts in sentiment and momentum are seen in almost every housing price cycle, but their precise timing is difficult to predict. As is evident in this next graph, these shifts in sentiment are clearly evident in the consumer surveys. Over recent times, the number of people reporting that an investment in real estate is the wisest place for their savings has fallen quite significantly. So it's not surprising that there are fewer investors in the market. At the same time, though, the number of people saying it's a good time to buy a home has increased quite substantially. As I said, lower prices draw more people back into the market, and eventually this helps stabilise things. So it's worth watching these shifts in sentiment quite closely. At a more fundamental level, an obvious question to ask is what are the underlying or structural drivers of the large run-up in housing prices and the subsequent decline? And there isn't a single answer to this question, rather it's a combination of factors at work. Before I discuss these factors, it's worth pointing out that the current adjustment's unusual. Unlike the four other episodes in which housing prices have declined over recent decades, this one was not preceded by rising mortgage rates. Nor has it been associated with a rise in the national unemployment rate. Instead, in New South Wales, where the recent decline in housing prices has been the largest, the unemployment rate has trended down. The latest figure is 3.9%, and you need to go back to the early 1970s to see a lower unemployment rate in New South Wales. The unemployment rate is also low in Victoria and has been trending down. So the origins of the current correction in prices do not lie in interest rates or unemployment. Rather, they largely lie in the inflexibility in the supply side of the housing market in response to large shifts in population growth. It's useful to start off with the national picture. As you can see here, Australia's population growth picked up noticeably in the mid-2000s, but it took the better part of a decade for the rate of home building to respond to this. It took time to plan, to obtain council approvals, to arrange finance and to build the new dwellings. Not surprisingly, given this delayed response, housing prices went up. Eventually, though, the supply response did take place. And as you can see, over recent times, the number of dwellings in Australia has been increasing at the fastest rate in more than two decades. Again, not surprisingly, prices have responded to the extra supply. That's how the market works. The population and supply dynamics are most evident in Western Australia and in New South Wales. During the mining investment boom, population growth in Western Australia increased from around 1% to around 3.5%. That's a very big change. The rate of home building, as you can see, was slow to respond. When it did finally respond, it was just at the time that population growth was slowing significantly as workers moved back east following the mining investment boom. This explains much of the cycle that we've seen in Western Australia. In New South Wales, it's a similar story, although it's not quite as stark. The recent rate of home building in New South Wales is the highest in decades. At the same time, population growth here is moderating, and that's partly due to people moving to other cities, attracted by their lower prices and lower rents. In contrast, in cities where the population patterns and the rate of home building have been more stable, prices too have been more stable. Another demand-side factor that has influenced prices is the rise and then decline in demand by foreign residents. One imperfect way of seeing this is the number of approvals by the Foreign Investment Review Board. In the middle years of the decade, there was a surge in foreign investment in residential property, particularly from China. This was apparent not just in Australian cities, but also in so-called international cities in other countries. In Australia, the demand was particularly strong in Sydney and Melbourne, given the global profiles of these two cities and their large foreign student populations. More recently, this source of foreign demand has waned, partly as a result of the increased difficulty of moving money out of China due to the tightening of the capital controls there. These timing in the shifts in foreign demand broadly coincided with and reinforced the shifts in domestic demand. However, making a full assessment of their impact on prices is complicated by the fact that international property developers were also adding to supply in Australia at the time that demand from foreign sources was very strong. More recently, these developers have scaled back their activity here. Domestic investors have also played a very significant role in this cycle. As you can see here, this is especially the case in New South Wales, which was the epicentre of the strong investor demand. at the peak of the boom, approvals to investors in New South Wales accounted for half of approvals nationwide. This compares with an average of around 30% in the 5 years before 2010. This is perhaps explained by the fact that 40% of new dwellings in New South Wales over recent years have been apartments, and these apartments tend to be more attractive to investors than houses. The strong demand from investors has its roots in the population dynamics. Low interest rates and favourable tax treatment added to the attraction of investing in an appreciating asset. The positive side to this strong demand by investors was that it helped underpin extra construction activity needed to house the growing population. But the rigidities on the supply side, coupled with investors' desire to benefit from rising prices in a low interest rate environment, amplified the price increases. As I discussed earlier, there is an internal dynamic to housing price cycles, and this one is no exception. By 2017, the ratio of the median home price to income had reached very high levels in Sydney and Melbourne, and you can see that in this chart. Finding the deposit to purchase a home had become beyond the reach of many people, especially first home buyers, if they didn't have outside support. At the same time, the combination of high prices and weak growth in rents meant that rental yields were quite low. So naturally, momentum in the market shifted. Given the big run-up in prices and the large increase in supply, a correction at some point was not surprising, although the precise timing is nearly impossible to predict. No discussion of housing prices is complete without touching on interest rates and the availability of finance. The low interest rates over the past decade increased people's capacity to borrow, and they made it more attractive to borrow, to buy an asset whose price was appreciating. So low interest rates did play some role. But the increase in housing prices is not just about low interest rates. The variation across the different housing markets indicates that city-specific factors have played a very important role too. Recently, much attention has been paid to the availability of credit. This attention has coincided with a noticeable slowing in the rate of housing credit growth, especially to investors, as you can see. It's pretty clear that there has been a progressive tightening in lending standards over recent years. The RBA's liaison suggests that, on average, the maximum loan size offered by new borrowers has fallen by around 20% since 2015. And this reflects a combination of factors, including more accurate reporting of expenses, larger discounts applied to certain types of income, and more comprehensive reporting of other liabilities. Even so, only around 10% of people borrow the maximum they're offered by their bank. Sensibly, most people borrow less than what they're offered, so the effect of this reduction in maximum borrowing capacity has not been particularly large. It's also been apparent through our liaison that some lenders have become more cautious over the past year. There was a heightened concern by some loan officers about the consequences to them and their career prospects of making a loan that might not be repaid if the borrower's circumstances changed. So lenders did become more risk averse. This, along with the greater verification of expenses and income, led to an increase in average loan approval times, although some lenders have responded to this by investing more in people and in technology. Our liaison indicates that application approval rates have not changed that much. Overall, though, the evidence is that a tightening of credit supply has contributed to the slowdown in credit growth. The main story, though, is one of reduced demand for credit rather than reduced supply. When housing prices are falling, investors are less likely to enter the market, they're less likely to borrow. So too are owner-occupiers for a while. Consistent with this, the number of loan applications has declined over the past year. There is also quite strong competition for borrowers with low credit risk, which is not something that you would expect to see if it was mainly a supply-side story. This competition is evident in the significant discounts on interest rates available on new loans compared to the interest rates paid on outstanding loans. Even though the slowing in credit growth is largely a demand story, we're watching credit availability quite closely. It's perhaps stating the obvious to say that we want lenders who are both prudent and who are prepared to take risk. As lenders recalibrated their risk controls last year, the balance may have moved too far in some cases. This meant that credit conditions tightened more than was probably required. Now, as lenders continue to seek the right balance, we need to remember that it is important that banks are prepared to take credit risk, and it's important that they have the freedom and the capacity to manage that risk well. If they can't do that, then our economy will suffer. This brings me to the issue of how developments in the housing market have affected our broader economy. Movements in housing prices affect the economy through a lot of different channels. They influence consumer spending, including the spending that occurs when people move home. They also influence the amount of building activity that takes place. Changes in housing prices also have an impact on access to finance by small business, by affecting the value of the houses, which is used as collateral for loans. And finally, movements in housing prices can affect the profitability of our financial institutions. Today, though, I'd like to focus on the effect of housing prices on household consumption. My colleagues at the RBA have examined how changes in measured household wealth affect household spending. They estimate that a 10% increase in net housing wealth raises the level of consumption by around 0.75 percentage point in the long run, and by 0.75 percentage point in the short run, and by 1.5% in the long run. They've also examined how this wealth effect differs by types of spending. As you can see here, they find the wealth effect is highest for spending on motor vehicles and on household furnishings. They also find that for many other types of spending, the effect is not significantly different from zero. Part of the effect on spending on furnishings is likely to come from the fact that periods of rising housing prices are often associated with higher housing turnover, which generates extra spending on furniture. Over recent years, spending by households has risen at a faster rate than household incomes. In other words, the saving rate has declined, as you can see here. And the results that I've just spoken about suggest that rising housing wealth was part of the explanation here. And if so, falling housing prices and a decline in measured household wealth could have the opposite effect. The more important influence, though, is what's happening with household income. For many people, the main source of their wealth is their human capital. That's their future earning capacity. And as I've discussed on previous occasions, growth in household income has been quite weak for a number of years now. It's plausible that for a time, this didn't affect people's expectations of their future income growth. It didn't affect expectations of the value of their human capital. So they didn't change their spending plans very much, despite the current growth in income being quite weak, and as a result, the saving rate fell. However, as the period of weak income growth has persisted, it's become harder to ignore. It's become harder to pass it off as something that's just temporary. So expectations of future income growth have been revised down, and it's likely that this is affecting spending in the economy now. So my conclusion here is that wealth effects are influencing consumption decisions, but they're working mainly through expectations of future income growth. Swings in housing prices and turnover in the housing market are also having an effect, but they are not the main issue here. This assessment is consistent with the data on housing equity injection, which I'm showing in this next graph. Over recent years, households have been injecting very substantial equity into housing, and they have not been using the higher housing prices to borrow to support their other spending. And as you can see, this is in stark contrast to the period around the turn of the century when households were actually withdrawing substantial equity. Given this assessment, developments in the labour market are particularly important. A further tightening of the labour market is expected to see a gradual increase in wages growth and faster income growth. This should provide a counterweight to the effect on spending of lower housing prices. So, taking all these considerations into account, my view is that the adjustment that we're seeing in the housing market is manageable for the overall economy. It's unlikely to derail our economic expansion. It's also important to remember that this adjustment has some positive side effects, including making housing more affordable for many people. A related issue that the RBA has paid close attention to is the impact of lower housing prices on financial stability. In 2017, APRA assessed the ability of the Australian banks to withstand a severe stress scenario in which housing prices declined by 35% over 3 years, GDP declined by 4%, and the unemployment rate increased to more than 10%. I think you'd agree it's a severe stress. The estimated impact on bank profitability was substantial, but importantly, bank capital remained above regulatory minimum levels. This provides us with considerable reassurance that the adjustment in the housing market is not a financial stability issue. We have not experienced the very loose lending standards that were common in the United States before the housing crash there a decade ago, nor have we seen significant overbuilding in many parts of the country. Even so, non-performing housing loans in Australia have risen recently, although, as you can see, they remain low at less than 1%. The increase is most evident in Western Australia, where the unemployment rate has risen substantially. The national experience, though, is that low levels of unemployment and low interest rates allow most people to service their loans, even if weak income growth now means that household finances are sometimes strained. Our estimate is that currently less than 5% of indebted owner-occupied households have negative equity, and the vast bulk of these households continue to meet their mortgage obligations each month. One factor that has helped here is that the share of new loans with high loan-to-valuation ratios has declined substantially over time. You can see this in this chart. The nature of Australian mortgages, in which there's an incentive to make prepayments, has also helped. I would like to conclude my remarks with some words about monetary policy and highlight some of the issues we focused on yesterday at our board meeting. As you're aware, the current setting of monetary policy has been in place for some time now. A cash rate of 1.5% is very low historically, and it is clearly stimulatory. It's supporting the creation of jobs in our economy, and it's supporting progress towards us achieving our inflation objective. Looking forward, a key issue is the labour market. Achieving full employment is an important objective for us in its own right. But in addition, a strong labour market is the central ingredient to the expected pickup in inflation. We're expecting that as the labour market tightens, wage growth will increase further. In turn, this should boost household income and spending and provide a counterweight to the falling housing prices. The pickup in spending in turn is expected to put upward pressure on inflation. Of course, it's possible that inflation could move higher for other reasons, although the likelihood of this at the moment seems quite low. This means that a lot depends upon what happens to our labour market. The recent data on this front have been encouraging. Employment growth has been strong, the vacancy rate is at a record high, and firms' hiring intentions remain quite positive. And the latest reading on the wage price index also confirmed a welcome but a gradual pickup in wages growth, particularly in the private sector. Other indicators of the economy, though, paint a softer picture. We'll receive another reading on GDP growth later this morning, but it looks highly likely that growth in the second half of 2018 was less than growth in the first half of 2018. This is a similar picture to what we're seeing internationally. In a number of countries, including our own, there is a growing tension between strong labour market data and softer GDP data. We're devoting significant resources to trying to understand this tension. The board will continue to assess the shifts in the global economy, trends in household spending, and how this tension between the labour market and output data resolves itself. We have the flexibility to adjust monetary policy in either direction as required. There are plausible scenarios under which the next move in interest rates is up. There are also plausible scenarios under which it is down. At the moment, the probabilities appear reasonably evenly balanced. Given the various cross currents, the board's judgment remains that the most appropriate course is to maintain the current cash rate at its level of 1.5%. Thank you very much for listening, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Governor. There's a lot in that speech, and I think coming back to the... And thank you for taking some questions from myself and from, if we get time, from the audience. Perhaps the key thing that you were drawing out there when, as I was reading through the text of it, because there was so much there, was that you're saying that the origin, as I quote from you, of the correction in the housing prices, the big boom in housing prices and the bust now, do not lie in interest rates and unemployment, but they lie in the inflexibility of the supply side of the housing market in responses to large shifts in population growth. So I think you're saying that the shift in the shock of the population growth coming from the resources boom, which was caused the upswing in housing prices, rather than anything the Reserve Bank's done by getting monetary policy wrong or anything like that. That's your essential thesis there.
Broadly, that's correct. I mean, population growth picked up very quickly in Australia, and it took a long time for us to build the extra housing. What would you expect happen? Prices go up. That's how the market works. And the combination of the tax incentives and the low interest rates gave people extra incentive to borrow to buy an appreciating asset. And we know in these cycles, things always go too far. Eventually, supply comes on, prices start declining, and the investors leave the market, and we set up another cycle. That's what's happened here. Interest rates are part of that, but the main underlying dynamic is the adjustment on the supply side was very slow in response to a pickup in population growth, but the supply response did come. It came too late, though. And there's very little that monetary policy can do about that. There are underlying structural things that are going on, and we're just having to respond to it.
So on housing prices, which... everyone seems to be very interested in. And for the first time, I think you started to quantify what the bank thinks is the wealth effects, i.e. with house prices falling, how much that will weigh perhaps on consumer spending and in terms on the economy and what you can do with policy. Now, my reading of your parliamentary testimony the other day was that when you moved from just last month from a tightening bias to a neutral bias, you also signal fairly clearly there, I think explicitly, that whatever happens, you don't expect to be any increase in interest rates this year. Is that a correct reading of your position?
Well, it's hard to think of the scenario where interest rates would need to go up this year. The inflation pressures are very benign. Wage growth remains low, and the current rate of wage growth is unlikely to generate an inflation rate of 2.5%. And there are a number of other factors that are weighing on inflation at the moment. There continues to be strong competition in the retail sector, and governments are responding to the cost of living pressures that people feel by reducing the prices of the services that they deliver, or at least reducing the rate of increase. So there are quite a lot of things weighing on the rate of inflation at the moment. So I think it's quite unlikely that inflation is going to be a problem anytime soon, and if it's not, then we can keep with the current setting of monetary policy for some time.
So signalling to the market and to people in the housing market or looking to get into it that you're not going to do any short-term interest rate rise, do you hope that that will put a bit of a cushion under the housing price fall so as to maintain your consumption forecasts and your GDP forecasts?
Well, the signalling of a neutral stance of monetary policy isn't to try and support the housing market. It's really a reflection of the circumstances we face. But what we do see in the housing market recently is an increasing number of people saying it's a reasonable time to buy a home. And that's what happens when prices adjust. People come back into the market. Investors are still kind of not coming back in significant numbers, but first home owners and upgrade buyers are starting to think, well, maybe at lower prices we can enter the market, and I think that will eventually stabilise things. Because there aren't underlying structural imbalances here.
So you don't think the nature of the big run-up means that there's a significant risk of even further very large-scale falls in the housing market?
I mean, it's possible, but there isn't an underlying structural adjustment problem. We have not built too many houses, so we've basically built enough for the growing population. So I don't see we're building up excess stock in the housing market, which needs to be cleared with lower prices. We're really seeing the unwinding of the speculative dynamic caused by the structural factors and then investors coming in and pushing things too far. And as prices come down, people are being drawn back into the market. And just in the last few weeks, we've seen the auction clearance rates in Sydney and Melbourne move up a little bit, which is encouraging relative to the alternative scenario of them falling further.
I'm interested in your thoughts on this vexed question of weak wages growth that we heard of this morning earlier from the Leader of Opposition and you referred to as well. And going over some of your recent testimony, am I getting this depiction right, that over the past decade, wages or household incomes have got the sort of normal boost from the rate of labour productivity growth that there has been, that the labour productivity growth by and large has been distributed to the share to labour as you'd normally expect. Perhaps in the first half of the last decade, you got more, and now with after the mining boom, there's been less, but overall there's been a what you might call the normal or fair share of income has gone to labour.
Yeah, but if you take the last decade as a whole, the increase in real consumer wages in Australia has broadly matched the increase in labour productivity. That's what you would expect to happen over long periods of time. But in the last 5 years, that has not been the case. There's been reasonable productivity growth in the Australian economy. It'd be better if it were higher, but there's been reasonable productivity growth, but little increase in consumer wages. So workers feel like they haven't got their normal share. In the 5 years before that, it was the reverse. We had quite large increase in consumer wages. Wages were growing quite quickly and inflation was low, and there was quite low underlying productivity growth in the economy. But taking the 10 years as a whole, things have worked out. The important question that I don't think anyone knows the answer to is the last 5 years the start of a new structural trend where workers don't get their normal share, or is it just the unwinding of the previous 5 years associated with the mining investment boom? I think both explanations are plausible, but no one can be confident about that.
And that change between the first 5 years and the second 5 years was largely to do, it seems, to higher export prices for commodities in the first 5 years, which boosted national income. There's more money to go around and less in the second half.
Yeah, 5 years ago I remember giving a talk saying, well, our real consumer wages in Australia are growing quite quickly, but productivity growth was quite weak. And the reason we were able to pay ourselves more in real terms was that the price of the resource exports were rising so quickly. Mm. And we were all benefiting from that. And as the price of our resource exports have come down, that's had to be unwound. So I think it's probably the case that some of what we've seen over the last 5 years is the unwinding. But I also think it's partly structural, because we're seeing in many countries around the world the same phenomenon play out. They didn't have kind of the mining investment boom to kind of make things difficult to interpret, but we've seen in many countries the growth of real incomes for workers fall short of growth in productivity. And I think the underlying factor here is perceptions of competition from globalisation and technology. It's weighing on everyone's pricing power. So there's something deep and structural going on. In my own view, it's not really part of something coming from the industrial relations system. There are global factors at work that are holding down the growth of wages. But I'm still optimistic that the laws of supply and demand work. And I say that because you look in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in Germany, even in Japan now, where the unemployment rates are the lowest in 40 years, wage growth is picking up in all those countries. Not rapidly, but it is picking up. And even in Australia, the rate of wage growth as measured by the WPI, including the measure the measure includes bonuses, has gone from around 1.75% a year ago to 2.75% now. So there has been a pickup in wage growth in Australia. I think it'd be better if it were stronger, but there has been a pickup as the labour market tightens. So we're seeing this internationally as well. So if you tighten up the labour market sufficiently, wage growth will pick up, and that's underlying, that's our hope, and that's really our strategy. Keep interest rates low, labour market tightens, wage growth picks up and inflation returns to trend, and I think that's working.
If you get nominal wages growing as the labour market tightens a bit more, and you also get inflation going up a bit more, which you want to see in the middle of the band, would workers be any better off?
Workers will... If nominal wages are growing more quickly, that helps people with debt. Because I think many people borrowed on the assumption that their incomes would grow at the old rate, let's say 4%, and a number of years down the track, they're finding they're growing at 2%, so it's harder to kind of pay down the debt. So faster nominal growth would help people with debt. Mm. But in the end, what really matters is real growth in wages. And the underlying thing there that we need to do is to lift productivity growth, isn't it? And there are a lot of things we could do there, but
what would be your top of your list at the moment?
I don't have an ordered list, but I do collect ideas. and there are so many reports out there to give us ideas. The Productivity Commission last year had the Dahl report. It talked about the way the government delivers services in cities. There are a lot of things that could be done there. The IMF has also pointed to the way we build infrastructure and the pricing of infrastructure. Mr. Shorten talked about the importance of human capital accumulation. I think this is probably the number one thing we can do, is because in the end, whether my kids have a much better living standard than I do will be not because of what we find in the ground or grow on the ground, but because what's in here or what's in their heads. So it's human capital accumulation, which is incredibly important, and the opportunities in the world are just so exciting. There's so many opportunities there, and I am sometimes a bit disappointed at the amount of R&D that Australian businesses are doing and the training of their staff that they've been doing. So in the last decade, I think as businesses felt things were pretty tight, they probably did not do enough training of their staff, and R&D in Australia is, in my view, is too low, and that's partly the responsibility of business but also of government. So they're the areas that we're looking at. I think the IMF has also identified the structure of our tax system, the way we tax wealth creation versus consumption, and the way we tax land. I don't think anyone who looks at our taxation arrangements for land would say they're optimal. So on productivity, there are a large list of things that could be done. None of them are politically easy, though. But if our living standards are going to rise at anything like the old rate, we need to do some of those things.
So there is a question. There is one. We'll have a quick one down here.
Hi, thank you. I'm Sandy Plunkett. I'm an independent. In speaking about what you think of the structural changes to low wage growth or stagnant wage growth, globalisation and technology. I was wondering if you can give us any sort of clarity on, in Australian businesses, the level of investment in technology in that five-year period where wage growth has been low. I'm just wondering whether we're underweighting the impact of technology, and as business decision makers are really trying to assess network effects, platforms, whatever, and whether they're actually putting the money elsewhere.
Well, I don't have the figures to hand, but I've read a number of international reports which show spending on R&D by Australian businesses is not in the top quartile. It's, in some of those reports, it's kind of in the bottom quartile. I think that is an issue, and I understand in the past decade things have been tough in parts of the Australian business sector, and one of the things that's been cut is spending on R&D, or at least not increased, and the same thing is happening on training of workers. Almost every single business meeting I go to at the moment, businesses complain how hard it is to get workers with the appropriate skills. And you see this in the business surveys where businesses are asked about the constraints on their production, and increasingly It's the availability of skilled workers. So business has a responsibility to invest in upgrading the skills of the workforce to boost levels of R&D, because in the end, as I said before, it's what's in here that's going to determine our future living standards, and we need to invest in that. And my view is we're probably not doing what we should be.
Okay, well, we're almost... Just one quick one.
Hi, Governor. John Keogh from the Australian Financial Review. Thanks for that speech. Just wondering on inflation targeting, we are in probably a structurally lower inflation world now, partly due to those themes you mentioned, globalisation and technology. In Australia, is there a case to consider at some point perhaps adjusting inflation target from 2 to 3% to 2% like the Fed does? And secondly, can the softness in the consumer side of the economy be offset by, we're seeing some positive signs in business investment and plans for investment as well, and credit growth is better for business as well?
Yeah, you're right. On the business investment looks like it's on a fairly reasonable upswing at the moment. So businesses are investing and they're employing people. The puzzle we're grappling with at the moment is where's the associated spending and output. So businesses are employing more people and people are getting bigger wage increases, but it doesn't seem to be showing up either in the spending or output figures. So we'll get another reading of that in an hour's time, and I hope it'll provide some clarity, but that's a puzzle. I don't see a case for adjusting the inflation target range at the moment. We've had this arrangement for the better part of 30 years, and it's worked well. People understand the arrangement. I'm confident that we'll get back to 2.5% inflation. It's just taken a little time to get there. Inflation's lifted. It's already higher than it was a year or year and a half ago. And wage growth is lifting as well, which should gradually push inflation up. I don't see what we would get from lowering the midpoint of the inflation range from 2.5% to 2%. To think that's the solution to many problems, I think, is fanciful. So we've had the arrangement for a long period of time. It's well understood, and I think it's worth keeping it.
Mm. So, Governor, thank you very much. You did mention the GDP numbers coming out in less than a couple of hours. And as you say, people are expecting putting the partials together to be on the soft side. Anything can happen, of course, but given the strength of the labour market numbers that you point out, you doubt that the economy is perhaps as weak as some of the suggestions that are coming from the GDP numbers.
The GDP in the September quarter was 0.3, and I don't know what today's number is, but taken together, the September and the December quarters will show growth significantly below trend and substantially below what it was in the first half of the year. If you look at the other indicators of the economy, you don't see that slowdown. The labour market data suggests the economy is growing quite well. Lowest unemployment rate in a long time, highest vacancy rates, every business saying it's hard to get workers. So the labour market data say things are going pretty strongly. The GDP data, we'll see what they say in an hour's time. I hope they'll resolve the puzzle, but I suspect they won't. And we'll be talking about this issue for some time, how it is that workers are getting higher pay rises, firms are employing workers, but it's not showing up in the output and spending data.
Okay, that is it. Gentlemen, can you please put your hands together to thank very much Philip Lowe, Reserve Bank Governor.
Thank you.
Thank you, President.